Hello and welcome from me, Jenny Devitt, to Countryside Matters. Today in the programme, we'll hear from Trevor Bailey about why he thinks Dorset and rural England are facing an unprecedented assault, those are his words, from housing developers. One of what many see as a major downside to developments is increased light pollution. Dr. Jenny Hall is a great advocate of the pleasures of having dark skies and of something called dusking. She'll explain later. And some terrific news about Upton Heath. The Dorset Wildlife Trust's campaign to raise enough money to buy a piece of that heath to stop possible mineral extraction has succeeded. Brian Bleese will tell us more. First, Trevor Bailey, who's a long-standing rural development advocate and resident of the village of Boughton in North Dorset. He wrote an open letter in the BV magazine in which he argues that current government housing policy is leading to an unprecedented assault on rural England. And of course, he's speaking more personally about Dorset. When I spoke to Trevor, I said that I sensed real anger in his article.
There is anger. It's not just because of what's happening locally, although that obviously in our own village is pretty significant. It is a matter of the sheer crudeness of the policies that are bringing this about. I mean, if you compare what the Labour government did after the war with what the Labour government is doing now, you see the contrast. Then, even when there was enormous pressure economically because of the effects of the conflict, it was possible to build council houses, low-rent houses, so that people could stay in their villages. Now we have a policy which is build, 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 which means simply handing over the countryside, really, to developers to do as they wish. Now that sounds like an exaggeration, but it's not much of an exaggeration. And the problem that arises, of course, is that inevitably developers want to build expensive houses for people who already have houses and money to buy houses. And they advertise them in London. And at the end of the day, what actually happens, and I don't want to be offensive about it, but it does end up with further disgorging of retired London professionals into the countryside, which is one of the main reasons why house prices have been so high in rural areas. It doesn't matter. I mean, it's fine to have a mixed community, but when one economic group becomes terribly dominant, that makes life very difficult for others. Such people of reasonable wealth don't need rented houses. They don't need public transport. They probably don't need local shops. We end up, by degrees, and it's already gone an awfully long way, with a countryside without country families left in it at all. Those, really, I think, are the principal reasons for my anger about all of this. It's almost as though politicians see urbanisation as progress, as the very definition of progress, as if no other form of community existence can be. And that is very problematic, I think.
Is it also, Trevor, partly a question of an imposition of, in this case, housing, it could be solar farms, it could be wind turbines, on an area of low population because that means low opposition?
Yes. And what is really worrying about this, of course, is the undemocratic nature of the whole thing. I mean, what's happening in our own village here, Boughton, is that we're going to get 80 new houses, which have been awarded on appeal after having been rejected by Dorset Council and opposed by the mass of the population. There's also the prospect of another 125 houses in the local plan. Now, that together would virtually double the population and, of course, add another 250 or more cars. That changes the whole place, socially, economically, environmentally. And it also opens huge further areas to potential development because these sites that have been approved are outside the neighbourhood plan area. The neighbourhood plans are pretty much out of the window. People have worked on those, communities have worked on them carefully and at considerable expense, and they no longer mean anything. So that's part of it. But I think it's also exactly what you suggested. Unless you have the weight of numbers, you really don't have any great impact. And it's a foolish idea to think that the countryside is some kind of open space where nothing happens and which can be utilised simply to provide sort of life support systems for the cities, which is what's going on here, really. I mean, to take the whole issue of electricity generation, obviously we do have to have sustainable energy creation, but it's not sensible, as far as I can see, to take enormous areas of productive land, and some of the proposals are truly enormous, and turn them into power stations, essentially for the cities where most power is consumed. You have to have, obviously, great battery installations as well as the solar panel and wind farm installations themselves. You have to have transmission lines running across country, all entirely new. The old ones are in the wrong places, of course. And it seems so obvious that there is no reason at all why energy should not be generated where it is most consumed, in the cities themselves. I mean, look out over London, Birmingham, Manchester, Liverpool, Newcastle, Glasgow. It's one vast roofscape. Now, why aren't those roofs covered in solar panels? Why aren't those enormous tower blocks covered in solar panels? You know, if even as the CPRE have advocated endlessly, just industrial and commercial buildings had to have their roofs covered in solar panels, that would be an immense acreage. But the problem is the usual one, that doing this sort of thing in the countryside, on green fields, makes more money. It's nothing to do with what's needed. It's to do with the readies that can be accumulated from it.
You say it makes more money, but why should it make more money than putting solar panels on existing, say, industrial buildings and other buildings within an urban area?
Well, I think that's absolutely true. It's sensibly, it shouldn't. You would think that putting panels on an existing structure would be perfectly simple. But I think the answer is that it's easier. You know, you can grab hold of large areas of land and you don't have to do it piecemeal, building by building, that kind of thing. And there is to do something on industrial buildings requires a measure of compulsion or at least expectation. And that is not present. The government is not pursuing that policy to any great extent. Those, I think, are the problems.
Now, Trevor, just to come back to you talked about the neighbourhood plan earlier. Now, from what you say in your article, it does seem pointless and a total waste of everyone's time to put together a neighbourhood plan since those plans don't appear to be taken into account.
Well, that is so. I mean, in our case in Boughton here, and it's far from being the only one, the areas that are going to be developed are outside the neighbourhood plan boundaries. They are completely in conflict with the neighbourhood plan. And doing that, of course, opens up a whole vast area of other land within the area between the village and the bypass, for example, which developers are now bound to go for. It's only a matter of time. If you can do it in two places, you can do it in others. And the other problem is that, of course, as a place is grown, as it becomes bigger, it becomes more of a target for development, just as has happened with Gillingham. I mean, that is now several times the size it was when I first knew it. And it's already receiving enormous development now. I think it's 1,800 houses. And it will get much more. The bigger the place, the more it gets.
One of the things, and you touch on again on this in your article, one of the things that one hears time and again is how no additional infrastructure is provided or even taken into consideration in developments, particularly the large ones.
Yes, we hear a fair amount about 106 agreements. You know, the developers will have to pay something into the coffers, which will enable there to be some provision locally. But that's not what's required. That's a one-off payment. What's required, of course, is long-term funding for additional medical facilities and staff, additional school teachers, additional care facilities. And those you don't just pay for those in a one-off way. They're required long-term, for years, for decades. And there is no sign of any provision for that, certainly not in our own case here.
And you mentioned democracy earlier, and you're critical of the current government, and I guess a lot of people would very much agree with your sentiments. People do say that democracy is not alive and well when it comes to housing developments, but dead in the water. Would you agree with that?
As things are at the moment, yes. If you're going to have, I mean, I don't blame the local authorities for this, really. They're acting under direction now. They don't really have much leeway at all. It does mean that you end up with local people not just feeling, but knowing that they can't have any impact at all. You know, their wishes, the wishes of the local authority that they elected that represents them, totally disregarded. And decisions made centrally effectively on behalf of government, which are, as I said right at the beginning of this discussion, extraordinarily crude. They don't take any note of history. They don't take any note of the composition of communities. They don't take much notice of the services and facilities that are required. It's a crude bit of planning. It's just build and build. It will not do.
Now, you use the phrase in your article, Trevor, that the planning system seems increasingly centralised, which is pretty much what you've just been saying, and leaves villages and small communities feeling like helpless prey.
Yes, I think that's precisely what it is. And it comes back to what you were saying earlier about small populations and the inability of those to have adequate impact. It does seem as though everything is based upon an urban concept, and that's just an absence of knowledge at government level, I think. We badly, badly need a strong rural campaign, which I hope rural councils will take up as much as others, people like the CPR and others, in order to make any kind of impact. Because where we stand and how we feel is simply not understood.
And so much opposition to any development is simply put down to NIMBYism, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And that's really rather nasty. We want to live in small communities. We want to live in mixed communities with different people from different walks of life. We don't want to see the last of the country-born population shoved out. Now, these are not extravagant things to want. They're something which, you know, any small village wants to see. And yet it's disregarded and not understood. That's a great problem. But I've lived in the country all my life. I lived in this village for most of it. And the thought of having to exist in a totally different way, you have to live in a place where there are an awful lot of people you never really meet and never really know, it is anathema. It's just not what we're about. It's not the kind of people we are. And I think, you know, this has to be taken seriously. You're asking people not just to convert their communities, but to convert themselves into a different kind of animal. And that won't do.
Are there others who feel like you in that respect?
Yes, there are. And an awful lot, I think. I mean, I talk to all sorts of people about it. And I get this sort of feeling of some despair coming from a lot of people, particularly people who've lived here for a long time. And, you know, when you get to that stage, we really can't, you know, the idea that we really can't influence anything, we can't change anything, we can't protect anything, then you begin to worry very seriously. Certainly rural areas have got to do their bit when it comes to the problems of the country. But you're not going to solve housing problems by building more and more and more and more expensive houses, which attract people from outside. We need low-rented housing for people who cannot afford houses at all. So-called affordable housing still has to be bought. If you can't afford actually to buy a house, then you're in a different category again. You have to rent, and it has to be a reasonable rent. The Labour government that built council houses after the war saw this and did something about it. A modicum of decent rented houses in villages would be very welcome, I'm sure. But not something that just sells you to the urban world.
To come back to the greenfield, so the greenfield sites versus brownfield sites, which you mentioned earlier, and you say there are, and plenty of people say the same thing, that there are lots of brownfield sites in urban areas. Now, presumably those are harder to develop and also harder to sell houses that might be built on them?
I don't know about whether it's not as harder to sell. I mean, houses in cities tend to sell pretty well. Yes, it is more expensive to, or shall we say less profitable, to build on brownfield sites. Of course it is. And that's the reason why developers want green fields. That's where profits can be maximised. But if we're only talking about maximising profits rather than need, surely we're really on the wrong wicket altogether. The whole excuse for all this development is housing need. Let's treat it as need and not as opportunity to make cash.
Trevor, you raise one extremely important and very timely matter in your article, that of the fact that this country is a long way from being self-sufficient in food. Is enough attention being paid by development decision makers to the need to keep farmland productive rather than concreted over, do you think?
No, I don't think it comes into planning considerations very much at all, if at all. Planning concerns are very limited, in fact. I'm not the world's expert, but that's fairly evident when you come to try and protest about some planning proposal, because your protest only has any meaning if it corresponds to a very few parameters. We are importing nearly half of the food that we eat. That makes us, in any kind of emergency, very vulnerable. And that's a rather foolish position to be in. If you're going to start consuming very significant amounts of productive land, and that is being done, you must inevitably be further limiting the amount of food production that there can be. It's most unwise. It's taking us in entirely the wrong direction. We should be producing more food, not less. We have a population approaching 70 million, and it's growing still. That's not being planned for in terms of food production or the future of farming. This is why I say, really, that, you know, what we're seeing is a kind of war, really, not just on beauty, not just on the coherence of communities, but also on farming and food production. Vital things for a country like this one. We know we're crowded. We know we have a major problem in terms of accommodating everybody. But you can't destroy even small amounts of food production and still expect to come out the other side glowing. You won't be. I don't think government at present understands rural life at all. We are thought of as a sort of hinterland, as an area which is not being exploited sufficiently. It must be, I suppose, difficult for people who've spent most of their lives involved with an almost entirely urban situation to actually understand that there is a somewhat different world out here, even now in the 21st century. It's almost as though people have missed some level of their education. They cannot understand these things. I'm glad to say that. I mean, I've been pushing my thoughts around to various politicians, and I had a very long response from the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government, which was very largely cut and paste, I think. But I did get a very interesting reply from Gideon Amos, the Liberal Democrat spokesman on housing and communities, who was very strongly in agreement and tells me that he is trying to push these concerns that we're discussing strongly in the Commons. Now, there's always a difference in politics between words and action, but that at least was encouraging. Some people I've sent things to haven't replied at all, which for MPs I think is rather bad. I won't name any names. But it has penetrated a bit further. In Wiltshire, Andrew Murrison, MP in South West Wiltshire, Tory in his case, has written in the Blackmore Vale magazine recently, bringing up just some of these points. He did reply to me when I sent my missive to him. So I think there are differences in political attitudes, and I suppose if one's being really cynical about it, these concerns don't arise so much in Labour constituencies as they do in others.
Finally, Trevor, you've talked about writing to MPs. What can we as individuals, the rural dwellers, the helpless prey, in your words and from your article, what can we try and do to try and stop what might call a tide of housing developments from flooding our landscape?
We have to be heard. I think it's a matter of trying to get the councils in rural counties to band together and get their voices heard. So you have to tackle them, you have to tackle councillors. I mean, I've been carrying on a dialogue with the leader of Dorset Council, who I must say does respond very well. We have to write to the media, we have to get stuff in the media, we have to do just what we're doing now and get our voices heard. We have to fight like hell, because this is becoming something of a serious emergency for the future of rural life. You can only go so far in devouring the land and in devouring rural tradition before it all disappears completely. So I think it's a matter really of get after your elected representatives as strongly as you possibly can, your MPs, your councillors. Don't stop. Just keep on bombarding them. And if you happen to be in a Labour constituency, do it doubly hard.
Trevor Bailey. And if you agree with Trevor, then maybe follow his example. And that interview appears in the BV podcast, which is part of the excellent online BV magazine. And many thanks to the editor, Laura Hitchcock, for letting us use it. I came across a fascinating online article recently about something I'd personally never heard of before. The article was written by Dr. Jenny Hall, and it was about dusking. And it was also about the value of dark skies to us humans and to nature. I asked Jenny to explain.
Well, dusking is a new phrase being applied to something that is very ancient, which is a moment in human life when we experience the transition from daylight to nighttime. So that period of dusk when we watch the sun go down.
It is and can be a rather magical time, can't it?
Absolutely, yeah. It's a beautiful time of day. That transition and transformation towards night is wonderful. And listening and experiencing nature's transition from day to night is also wonderful. So, you know, robins are often the last birds that we hear during the day. And then you transition into that moment where nocturnal species emerge, and you hear the owls and the foxes and so on.
Now, as a species, of course, most of us miss all that. We've learned on the whole, haven't we, to become afraid of the dark. And as soon as it gets dark, we switch on the lights, we draw the curtains, we shut it all out, don't we?
We do, yeah. Our obsession with lighting up the night sky is quite serious in terms of the impact on not just human health, but also nocturnal biodiversity and our access to the night skies. So if we think about the population in the United Kingdom, probably only 85% of people in the United Kingdom have actually access to dark skies in the true sense, where you could see, you know, a good array of stars and experience seeing the Milky Way, which is of course the galaxy which we share, we are part of.
So tell me, what's the this is a relatively new trend, is it, that what you refer to as dusking?
Yeah, it's a renewal and a revival of an ancient practice of watching the sun go down. And there are, you know, many cultures treat this as a very special time of day and have done historically. But in modern life, we've lost the art of experiencing and being part of the dusk. So artists in the UK and also in Holland are looking at how we reconnect back with the night and encouraging people through Morris dancing, through poetry, and through just being there at dusk and watching and taking some time out of the day to experience that transition of the sun going down has become something where, or a special moment where we can connect with the nighttime.
Now, you mentioned a moment ago that it is an ancient tradition and certain cultures would sit and watch. Presumably that meant the dusk also had a spiritual significance, did it?
Yes, definitely, because you're saying goodbye to the sun. So, you know, the sun brings life and the opportunities to, because we are a diurnal creature, so it's when we're most active. So the loss of the sun going down at night means that we go into darkness, and you know, that can be a very scary thing. Will the sun come back up again, you know, in the morning? So there are many religious and spiritual stories about, you know, if you think about ancient Greek culture and the descent into Hades. Yes, we've got a lot of history and heritage there that we've lost touch with, and that's a bit of a shame.
And of course, also goes back to the ancient Egyptians, doesn't it?
Yes, of course. Yeah, it does.
So what's actually the, you say it gives us a chance to reconnect, but aside from the perhaps obvious spiritual benefit that we get, maybe the mental benefit, what are the other benefits of just sitting at the end of the day and watching the sun go down? That's if we can see it.
The benefits are to do with being connected to nature. And as you mentioned just then, you know, it's about our health and well-being. We've obsessed with lighting up the night sky, and sadly that has an impact on human health. So the delay of the circadian rhythm in the body means that, you know, it's well documented that release of melatonin in the body means that there's been an increase in serious health conditions such as heart disease, diabetes, weight gain, all the kind of big killers, cancer. So, you know, lighting up the night sky is very bad for our health. So actually taking a moment to enjoy the natural daylight and natural darkness is good for our health.
I suppose it's also a question of listening to our bodies and their natural rhythm, isn't it?
It is, yeah, and giving ourselves a chance to connect to something that, you know, not very long ago, in living memory, our grandparents, even for some of us, depending on how old we are, our parents were quite used to natural darkness and connecting with it. So, for example, walking at night in natural darkness, we've lost the art of using our night vision, because the body makes a natural transition and you can actually see far more than you think you can. You know, when you look out of the window and your room is brightly lit and it seems very, very dark outside, well, actually it's not that dark. And I've been taking people out walking at night and they've been absolutely astounded by the fact that the body will transition and make that transformation towards night. So our connections to natural darkness and enjoying it and seeing the stars has really been something that we've lost without even noticing. So, yeah, it's a bit of a shame.
When you take people out on those nighttime walks, presumably you forbid them the use of any torch, do you?
No, not exactly. In fact, it's a health and safety issue. So making sure people are safe is very important. But actually what I did find, I had a group of women who I was walking with, and they felt like they were walking and we were on difficult ground. And they said, I said, okay, you can maybe put your lights on, your head torches on now, because we're on technical, difficult, uneven ground. And they told me, oh no, we don't want to, because we're enjoying the feeling of being with the darkness. And if we put our head torches on, that's going to expose us, as make us feel exposed and visible to the night. So they were actually enjoying that moment of connecting with the nocturnal world. So we've lost those skills to walk at night in the dark, and also that feeling of being connected and part of it. And that overcame that feeling of fear of being in the dark.
So when they said to you they didn't want to be seen, presumably that's some ancient memory of being hunted by larger predators that might eat them.
Yeah. Well, interestingly, we had a woman who was from Calcutta on the walk with us, and she said to me, Jenny, she said, are there any predators out there that will eat me? And I said, no, not in the UK, unless you come across a particularly aggressive badger. You know, I think most things are more frightened of us than we are of them.
Yes, sadly, that is very much the case. Yes, she was obviously thinking there might be a tiger, yes, hiding somewhere behind that gorse bush.
Yes.
And this was up on the North York Moors National Park, where you did your field research, part of it anyway, was it?
That's correct, yeah. Yeah, we took groups out at night walking in various locations in the national park to explore how people connected with the nighttime And one of the key things that we did was making sure that we started at dusk. So we were dusking. We didn't call it that at that point, but we were making that transition into the nighttime so that it felt more comfortable for people. And then actually they began to experience that transition, the hearing of the last bird song, daytime bird song, and then that transition into nighttime sounds of the owls and the foxes and so on.
So, and tell me, did they start out feeling maybe a bit nervous and tense about the whole thing and then gradually relaxing as they became more confident?
Yes, absolutely. I think that, you know, culturally we have a lot of fear about the nighttime and darkness, and that is culturally ingrained. That's an ancient sort of fear about the loss of the sun and what that means for human life. And also then all those kinds of scary monster and, you know, the fear of the unknown out there. So I think, yes, we do have a lot of fears about the dark that are often based in mythology and not in reality. So people were really, really blown away by how that sensation and transformation in their bodies and through, you know, that transition from day to nighttime really impacted on them. So they really felt a sense of well-being, felt empowered to actually go out at night and enjoy the things that they were excluded from, which is the night sky and nocturnal environments.
And tell me, Jenny, did they find that they had a greater sense of their own fundamental wildness, perhaps, the fact that we're all creatures of the natural world, dependent on it and not separated from it. So somewhere maybe we still have a core of wildness.
I think there is, yeah, definitely. We, as human beings, we haven't evolved that much, and we have a deep, innate connection to nature. And given the opportunity, people really do feel and value that in a way that they hadn't appreciated. They didn't realize that they were missing out on those kinds of experiences. So nature connectedness has been proven to be a key way of improving people's overall well-being, mental health. So yes, definitely people were, one of the findings was that people were feeling that they felt a sense of that sense of well-being and calmness, the opportunity to kind of stop the everyday busyness of life and be aware and connect with their natural environment. So it was very important to them.
You just mentioned busyness, and I imagine that dusking would be particularly beneficial if you have had a very busy day.
Yes.
And particularly if you've had a very stressful one.
Yes, absolutely. You know, mental health and well-being and nature connectedness is a proven way of building a better and healthier lifestyle. So taking, you know, 20 minutes out of your day to watch the sun go down with a cup of tea or a flask or wherever you might be and experience the nighttime is good for your health. You know, in the North York Moors and the Dales at the moment, we're trialling a natural health service where people are being prescribed by their GPs the opportunity to go and experience the natural environment in the national parks. And that's proving to be very successful in terms of helping people's health conditions in a whole different variety of ways. So that's being trialled at the moment. So, yes, it's very important to human health that we find a way of reconnecting with our natural environments.
Yes, this is something that we hear increasingly these days. I think it's obvious that it'd be easy if you live in the countryside or by the sea just to sit and watch as the sun sets and the skies start to darken, but a whole lot less easy if you're an urbanite surrounded by a whole lot of artificial light.
You're absolutely right about that. And talking to the National Park about their Dark Skies Festival, for example, you know, only a certain a number of people can actually go and experience that. It's not possible for, you know, many of us or 85% of us who live in urban environments. So we in the city of York looked at the green spaces in the city and set up dark sky walks and dusking walks in the museum gardens, which is a green lung. It's a beautiful green space in the centre of York, and took people out for dark skies walks in the city. So we can find ways and moments where we reclaim our connection to nature. For example, like I hadn't appreciated, but apparently there are 173 different species of moth in the museum gardens and in York. And knowing that is amazing, because moths are as important, if not more so, as pollinators than bees, you know. And it's like looking after our nocturnal species is crucial.
And they don't like artificial, particularly LED light, do they?
They don't, no. It's very bad for them. Yeah, they get trapped in pools of light and then become exhausted and die or are predated on. So it does have an impact on the ecosystem significantly. Yeah.
Jenny, finally, I just wanted to, you mentioned dark sky festivals, of which there seem to be several up and down the country. How many dark sky reserves do we have here? I know Exmoor was the first, wasn't it? And the first in Europe?
Yes. I don't know if it was the first in Europe, but certainly the first in the United Kingdom. And in the UK, we have 7 international dark sky reserves, which is amazing when you think there are only 25 in the world. So we have a significant number in our national parks, particularly in the UK. So we're very well blessed. But the challenge that we have with that is that the encroachment of light pollution from urban areas is growing annually by up to 10%. So we've got to do things to look at responsible ways of lighting in our urban areas. So one of the reasons for bringing the Dark Sky Festival into the city of York is about raising awareness about responsible lighting. And that isn't about plunging us all back into darkness, absolutely not. It's about finding responsible ways of lighting our homes, our businesses, our streets even, with light when we need it, where we need it. If you think, you know, nationally in the Northern Hemisphere, 99% of artificial light at night is wasted. So think about the kinds of ways in which we could save on money from a sort of personal household perspective if we put different kinds of lighting into our homes. So it's it's an interesting challenge. Light pollution hasn't had its plastics moment, you know, where we all realised we had to do something about plastic waste. It's not had that kind of exposure or awareness. And I think, you know, it's one of the things that we can all do something about.
And then if that's the case, if we can all do something about it, then maybe we can all start benefiting from dusking.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, reconnecting with nature in a lovely, calm, beautiful way.
Do you know, you mentioned light pollution, even if you're in a dark skies reserve. And last summer, I went on a retreat in the Quantox, not far from the Severn. And although the sky was dark above, and it was also what was the edge of Exmoor, the light pollution from the South Wales coast or on the other side of the Severn was appalling.
It's very sad.
I talked to somebody a couple of years ago, and he said, actually, everybody thinks that it helps to reduce crime figures, but it does the opposite.
Yeah, that is true. So there was a study in, I think, Chicago, where they looked at two suburban streets in close proximity where there was a high crime level. And in one street, they increased the lighting, and in the other street, they reduced the lighting. Guess where all the crime happened? In the brightly lit street, because criminals need light to do what they do. So, I think the National Park, the North York Moors National Park, have been doing a significant amount of work with local farmers to improve lighting, and doing great work. I think the the same is true of Snowdonia. They've been doing work there, and I'm sure that's true of Exmoor. But going outside of the bounds of the national park, they can't really do that unless they work in partnership. So the North York Moors have been driving the development of a Northern England Dark Skies Alliance to deal with the challenge of the encroachment of light pollution from the A1 and A19 road corridors. Because of the increasing industrialisation, what we're getting is a light barrier which is preventing east to west nocturnal migration. So they're working hard to look at how they can deal with that issue. It's certainly in the north of England, not easy. I think it has to come via legislation. So the APPG on light pollution has yet to bring forward any meaningful legislation, notwithstanding the fact that they're trying very hard to do that, to bring legislation forward to tackle light pollution. You know, we've got examples. So France has legislation and they're applying that nationally to reduce light pollution across the country. So it can be done. It can be done. We've lost the art, and, you know, it's time to sort of turn back to nature and appreciate what we've got before we lose it. I mean, when you think, though, you know, I do have hope, because, you know, like we thought, oh, there'll be absolute mayhem and an uproar when we stopped having plastic bags in supermarkets, but everybody just accepted it. And I think if you give people easy ways to do the right thing, they generally will. You know, there is always a contingent of people who won't, but the vast majority of people will do the right thing if you make it easy for them. And you take the smoking ban. We all thought that was going to be an absolute battle, but it wasn't. Everybody just accepted it. So I think, you know, that moment, that plastics moment with light pollution needs to happen. We're on the sort of a rising wave, but we've got a way to go yet.
That was Dr. Jenny Hall, who's Associate Professor in Tourism and Events at York St. John University. You're listening to Countryside Matters with me, Jenny Devitt. And finally, a piece of really good news. One of the jewels in the Dorset Wildlife Trust's crown is the Upton Heath Reserve, north of Poole. The Trust used to lease a parcel of heathland roughly in the middle of the reserve, but a few years ago the landowner ended the lease and planned to put this bit of land up for auction at the end of April. The Trust then launched an urgent fundraising campaign to buy it, and the good news is they've raised the money. And as I said to the Trust's Chief Executive, Brian Blees, he must be delighted at this success.
Oh, absolutely thrilled. Yeah, it's an amazing, amazing result. Yeah, I mean, just a fantastic response from so many people, which has made this happen, really. So, yeah, we couldn't be happier.
And people outside Dorset or just within the county?
Well, we launched a public appeal, as you probably know, to try and raise funds. We had some leads on some significant contributions that needed matching, and demonstrating that community support is really important when you seek larger funds, of course. And we're absolutely delighted with the community response. I think we're up to nearly 1,800 individual donations, which is absolutely fantastic. And they helped us to match the funds committed by the local authorities as well, which include Dorset Council and Bournemouth, Christchurch and Poole Council have contributed substantial sums to the purchase. And a couple of individual major donors as well have put in substantial sums, as well as Dorset Wildlife Trust putting in a substantial sum ourselves from our own resources. It's an amazing response, and the community coming together to, you know, to really save Upton Heath, to really deliver something that is of such value to wildlife, to people, and to that community.
Did you, in fact, exceed the amount that you'd hoped to raise?
We pretty much hit it spot on, actually, because we had the purchase price, of course, and then you have to have legal costs on and things like that. And we also wanted to give it a bit of a start on restoration as well, so we were able to raise some funds towards that too. So it's covered everything we needed, which is fantastic.
That's marvellous. So have you, in fact, to coin a phrase, got the keys to the place now?
Not quite yet. We've exchanged contracts and we're due to complete in about 2 to 3 weeks' time. So we'll complete the purchase then. And then we will start the task of restoring it and hoping to get some community support for that. So we'll be launching a number of volunteer activity days. So inviting people to come along and help. The first thing we need to do, unfortunately, it's suffering from a bit of fly tipping and things like that. And so getting rid of those things, and then we'll build up to next winter. We'll be starting on addressing the scrub encroachment and those sorts of things and restoring the heath.
Last time we spoke, you said it had been very neglected since your lease was terminated. So first of all, you've got to get rid of the horrible stuff that's been fly-tipped. And then you say there's been encroachment by the heath. I was wondering, if it's been neglected over the last few years, is that altogether a bad thing? After all, you could say it's been rewilding itself.
Well, but heathland is a man-made habitat, which very much depends on continued human intervention. It's a habitat that's been created over thousands of years from people utilising it to cut bracken for bedding for animals, to cut gorse or furs for fuel. So the heather, of course, the heather habitat is the important one. And that gets outcompeted sometimes by other more robust species coming in. So scrub encroachment and also pine trees and things, of course, which spread onto our heaths, which are not native. So keeping on top of all that to maintain that healthy heathland structure is absolutely vital. And if you don't keep on top of it, it does decline, unfortunately. And that's what's happened over the last few years. So getting our wardens back on the site, getting volunteers back on the site and starting to manage the heathland properly again.
I was just wondering if you would leave a small parcel to see what would happen if you did nothing, no management at all.
Well, I think we know that from many years of heathlands being undermanaged, that they rapidly revert to woodland, often pine woodland, because there's quite a lot of pine plantation which does invade heathlands. So we know what would happen, but our challenge is to get that good heather structure back in place with scrub for nesting birds and those sorts of things. But the right balance of management is what's needed.
And of course, heather being fairly low growing, I imagine that is much of that scrub stuff like gorse.
Oh, it is indeed. So gorse and other higher growing plants and trees that do shade out the heather, reduce its quality, reduce its capacity for supporting ground nesting birds and that sort of thing.
So what else? I mean, what is heather good for? Presumably it's very good for insects. You've just said it's good for ground nesting birds. Is it good for the rare reptiles that are found on Upton Heath?
Absolutely. Sand lizards, for instance, they thrive in that environment. They need a good combination. They need some bare sand where they lay their eggs and can bask in the sun. But they also need the cover of the heather to avoid predation and that sort of thing. And the other, things like Dartford warblers need such things as fairly dense gorse. So not letting gorse get too long and too leggy where it's less advantageous for nesting birds.
And how long do you say that heathland has actually been managed for? It's hundreds of years, is it?
Well, heathland has been created over thousands of years, in fact, from when the primeval forests were first cut down by humans early on. Heathland was a habitat that developed and expanded in that time. And we've currently got about 20% of the heathlands left in Dorset that we had about 200 years ago, because they've been largely destroyed by things like forestry, often development, housing development, industrial development, agricultural improvements, all of which has gone to reducing the area of healthy heathland that we do have. So the heathlands we have now are somewhat fragmented, so it's so important that we've been able to bring Upton Heath back together, as it were. It's the 10th largest piece of heathland left in Dorset. So ensuring that doesn't get further fragmented and being able to manage as a whole now is a huge advantage going forward.
I suppose, Brian, it'd be easy to look at a piece of heathland, sort of scrubby heathland, and think, well, it's not much good for anything.
Well, that has been the case in the past, of course, where it was treated as wasteland to some extent. And, all sorts of development was allowed on heathland. Quite a few housing complexes, things were built on heathland in the past. And there's been so many people fighting the destruction of our heathland over decades. And finally, now all heathland does have protected status. mostly as SSSI, but also as Special Areas Conservation under the Habitats Directive, and a number of other designations, which some of the heathlands have too. That said, things like the Minerals Permission predate those protective designations, so that was an extant threat that we were concerned about. And as I said, I think I said when I spoke to you previously, that our great fear was that it would be bought by a speculative purchaser who would try and leverage, you know, the minerals, and we would be fighting again for years and years to come to try and stop that happening. So the fact that we have now been able to secure it for the future is fantastic response to, you know, from the community that's really demonstrated how much they value this heathland and how important it is, how important nature is to people.
And you are quite clearly very upbeat about the whole thing. I imagine that everybody, all the people who work and volunteer for the trust, also feeling delighted.
Absolutely. I mean, some of the messages that are attached to some of the donations have been so encouraging, and you know, it really is, you know, heartening to see that sort of response to what we do, to what Dorset Welsh Trust, what our members do, what our supporters do. And to know that the community really support what we do is hugely heartening and encouraging that we've got hope for turning around wildlife declines more widely.
Because so often, of course, you must feel that you're fighting a losing battle, or you know, a real uphill struggle to make a difference.
It is an uphill struggle. I never feel like I'm fighting a losing battle. I'm always very optimistic and very optimistic that people do want to support wildlife. So I think ultimately we will win the battle. Absolutely. We will win the war, and we will turn around wildlife declines, and we will bring nature back at scale. And the best way to do that is to make more space for nature in our lives, in our landscapes, you know, be it in our gardens, in our local parks, in our local green space, or on nature reserves, or on farmland. You know, making more space for nature to thrive, for nature to adapt, and adapting to climate change, of course, is a very important factor going forward. And nature needs space to do that. So bringing nature back at scale and making space for nature is our big message. And I'm so optimistic that we can do this. And this is the response here has been a great example that, you know, we have that support and we're going to keep fighting the fight.
I think those messages are getting through. So, Brian, just to come back to the reserve itself. So now, how big is the Upton Heath Reserve, or perhaps I should say, how big will it be once you've actually formally acquired this piece of land?
It'll be about 500 acres, which is quite large, almost surrounded by development. But there are some other bits of heath around it that we'd like to work on how we can make those connections in the landscape. And build those, you know, stepping stones and corridors through the landscape that allows wildlife to migrate and adapt.
Yes, because the wildlife corridors are very important, aren't they? Wherever they are.
They are indeed. And wildlife corridors can be many things. They can be lines of gardens, for instance, that allow nature to move around and to be supported. They can be green spaces through the urban conurbation that can be managed in favour of wildlife. By managing them for wildlife, we're also managing them for people to enjoy, for people to benefit from contact with nature. And more we know that contact with nature is good for physical and mental well-being. And these spaces, like Upton Heath, are so valuable to communities for having that contact with nature and all the benefits that that brings.
And, of course, anybody who has, or is lucky enough, like me, to have a garden, also knows the benefit. Brian, the Dorset Wildlife Trust has embarked on another big fundraising effort, this time for beavers.
Indeed. We'll be launching our beaver appeal this week. We need to raise some funds to enable us to carry out our consultation to look at our options for having wild beaver releases in Dorset. For 5 years, we've been running an enclosed beaver trial in West Dorset, which has been hugely successful. Beavers have bred very successfully on the site. Some of them have gone off to different areas now to be released into the wild. So there have been wild release in Dorset now, of course, at Little Sea with the National Trust at Stubborn. So we're now looking at how we can accelerate and how we can make that wild release happen more widely in our river system.
And those funds that you raise, what will they go towards?
They will cover monitoring and managing some of these places prior to the release, consulting with landowners, putting in management plans, and just making sure that the situation is, the environment is good for beavers.
Now, just finally, Brian, I know there's, I've heard there's been some dismay near Dorchester at what beaver dams could do to prevent salmon going upriver to their spawning grounds. How will you get around that one?
There are solutions to that. Dams can always be broken, of course, and we have something called leaky dams, which allow water to flow through them, and we can look at potential around fish passes and that sort of things around dams. So there are lots of solutions. And remember, beavers disappeared about 400 years ago, and prior to that, they were widespread in our landscapes, and salmon and other fish and other animals such as otters and things lived with beavers. So this is not something that would be unfamiliar to salmon as a species getting around beaver dams. So it's a natural part of the ecosystem. And putting in place some management measures that can make sure that continues to happen.
So the enclosed site, effectively, where several years ago the Trust released a pair of beavers, has been like a giant laboratory, hasn't it?
Indeed so, and we've been monitoring, observing them. We've been working with Exeter University to measure their impact on water quality, on siltation, on water attenuation. How does it manage water flows? And we've seen some very, very positive results around water flows. You know, that beaver dams, you know, they create lakes that hold water up. When there's too much water around in times of, you know, excessive rainfall, they will hold water up, slow it down from flowing downstream. When there's drought periods, then the water is still released from these stores to keep streams healthy through those periods as well.
Well, it all sounds very encouraging and very positive, and hopefully you'll get everybody on board with this one. And I look forward to the day, personally, when I can actually see a wild beaver myself.
Yeah, me too, absolutely. And I'm planning to go and see if I can spot one down at Littlesea very soon. And I think it's hugely encouraging that we're seeing species, we can see species like beaver coming back to our landscapes and all the benefits that they can bring.
Brian Blees, Chief Executive of the Dorset Wildlife Trust. And if you'd like to donate to the beaver campaign, just go on the Trust's website. The information and donation page is the first one that pops up on the homepage. And that brings us to the end of this edition of Countryside Matters. Thanks for listening, if you have been, and thanks to the Gardens Group for its support of the programme. So until next time, this is Jenny Devitt saying goodbye to you, and goodbye from a grunting beaver. Bye-bye.